Our last case to be argued this afternoon is docket number 24-1755, ASG Solutions Corp. v. United States. Mr. Demian, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. David Demian appearing on behalf of ASG Solutions Corporation, the appellant in this case. For all the reasons set forth in our briefing, the trial court erred when it determined that this contract was properly terminated for default and that that was justified. We request this court reverse that decision and enter remand with instruction to enter judgment in favor of ASG and against the Navy. In the alternative, the matter at a minimum should be remanded for further proceedings. First and foremost, this is...
Further proceedings, I take it, would be a trial, right?
If it proceeded to that length, yes. Yes, Your Honor. It would be a trial. Yes. There'd be fact issues to resolve. Because first and foremost, this is a firm fixed price, performance-based non-personal services contract. And the trial court's holding and the Navy's interpretation, which held that the central purpose of this contract is staffing supply, is not a permissible construction of this contract, nor do we believe it's a reasonable construction. So both of those create issues on appeal. ASG and Mr. Banerjee have been made to suffer the consequences of that interpretation via their debarment and the ending of their business. This started 3 years ago, and unfortunately, while we appreciate being here in the court's consideration of this matter, it's not a place we would like to be. And we're here to seek justice for Mr.
Does the debarment on appeal?
I'm sorry, it is not. It is not.
He has been debarred, is that?
That was correct. He was debarred, and then that debarment proceeded, and then the ultimate conclusion of that was the Navy reinstated him after all of his contracts. After all of his contracts were lost, yes. such that he no longer has any business with the government. So the bottom line is this issue that the court's interpretation, right, finds that and leaned on a determination that a central purpose here was the supply. And as we've laid out in our briefing, right, that interpretation, it leads to an unavoidable conflict with the statutes and regulations governing this type of contract procurement. FAR Section 37-101 provides the basis for this contract to be procured along with 37-104, along with FAR Part 16. Part 16, it's firm fixed price, right? It's not a level of effort contract. FAR 37-104, it's not a personal services contract. FAR 37.101, it's a services contract. The goal of this contract is to provide services to complete advisory and assistance services and tasks. And by interpreting it to be strictly a manpower, a contract providing manpower as the central purpose, then we have the government sidestepping the Services Act and its procurement authority to issue this contract. And the consequence of that, in the context of termination for default, which is why there are specific safeguards in place for the government to follow certain rules and make a careful determination before drilling the death knell into a contractor in this case.
Do you agree that the Navy had notices that gave ASG an opportunity to cure?
Yes, I would be happy to address that. So the notices to cure. So let's get to 52249-8. Okay. And those notices to cure, which under the clause that contract clause authorizing the government to terminate for default, provides that the little Romanet 1, 2, and 3, three different bases, all of which are only implicated if there's an endangerment of performance, which there is not in this case because all tasks were performed. Two, that the contractor received the notice to cure. And so the distinction here is that that notice to cure should notify the contractor of what it must do to cure, to make it an effective notice to cure. So what must it do to cure? And we're in a little bit of a roundabout, tying back to what's the central purpose of the contract. Because under Little Romanet 2, they're entitled to have that opportunity to perform the advisory and assistance services required. In this case, We performed all the services required, and only on the eve of the dispositive motion in this case was information as to some other tasks presented in the trial court, to which we objected.
How many resumes did you ultimately end up submitting to the Navy? How many?
I do not have the exact number of the total of resumes. What I will say is the resumes were submitted, and immediately upon submission, the dispute exploded, and Contracting Officer Iceland instructed my client to submit only those that meet the criteria on Attachment 2, thereby completely handicapping what types of resumes could be submitted. And those submissions further handicapped by the absence of specific tasks to perform. Right?
How did that handicap the contractor if the contract is correctly understood as obligating the contractor to provide 20 resumes that are of qualified experts per attachment to, and likewise actually provide the services of 20 experts during the course of the contract?
Well, Your Honor's question presumes that attachment 2 is a mandatory requirement for the contractor to provide exactly those hypothetical persons. And so...
Well, there is some flexibility in the mix of experts that can be provided, but nevertheless... they have to have some kind of qualifications.
Yes. They have to have the qualifications necessary to perform all the types of advisory and assistance services specified in the personal work statement in Section C. And so that statement contemplates a hypothetical situation across all different disciplines, fire protection, cost engineers, structural engineers, all types of engineers, architects. Right, not providing professional services, but providing advisory and assistance services. So getting back to Your Honor's point, how is the contractor handicapped? Without the government working with the contractor to notify them of what those services specifically are and what those tasks are, the contractor, who in a performance-based acquisition must maintain the how of the performance to benefit the government, is not able to solidify that technical approach. And so that technical approach cannot be and should not be fixed in stone by attachment 2. And that really gets to the whole of the thing. The government and the lower court determined that attachment 2 fixes in stone the technical approach of the offeror, of the contractor. And it cannot do that.
To my question about the number of resumes, in appendix page 4613, it says ASG submitted 18 resumes. Do you have any reason to disagree, or do you agree with that statement in paragraph 13 on that page?
I do not disagree with that statement. But again, and it goes back to my response to that question, is the resumes submitted were restricted based on the government's insistence on what those resumes must consist of, and thereby taking away from the contractor the ability to determine the technical approach that he was hired to provide.
Why is the government not entitled to say that we want expertise here? We're looking for expertise. And expertise, by our definition, is the following. You must be X, Y, Z, experience, education, dealing with DOD problems. Why isn't that something that in a contract like this, the government is not entitled to ask for?
It must be tied. Those characterizations and expectations as to that experience and criteria are in the performance work statement
right.
In C, generally. Okay. And that is the driver. So when they go to attachment 2 about what they're specifying, it must tie and link to what is in the performance work statement, which is the specific tasks that they're looking to have performed. Otherwise, what we have is a staffing supply contract.
But I don't think you answered Judge Bryson's question. Can you answer his specific question that he asked you?
Is why the government may specify the characteristics and the criteria that it seeks in connection with the work that it's looking to get done.
Let me give you an example. Suppose that the Department of Defense has a very complex legal problem in Kyrgyzstan, and they decide there's no one in the United States that knows Kyrgyzstani law, so we are going to contract with a Kyrgyzstani law firm, and they are going to give us advice as to how to handle this complex legal problem. Why can't the government say, we want this law firm to provide for us at least five lawyers who have at least 10 years of experience in dealing with contracts, and they must all be at the partnership level or equivalent in Kyrgyzstan. Why isn't that perfectly legitimate?
They may do that, Your Honor, and they must specify the problem that they are seeking to have solved, the task to be performed.
Well, but they don't know exactly what the problem is going to be yet, but they know from, they can understand the TC the tea leaves, they know that they're going to have problems coming down the road, and they want a team of lawyers that's ready to jump onto the task. Why isn't that legitimate?
It is legitimate for them to specify the criteria in the contract that they are seeking to have met.
In
this case, it's not in the contract in this case, Your Honor. Attachment 2 is not in the contract, and it's not a binding obligation.
But the 20 employees at relatively high levels, that's in the contract multiple times, starting with attachment A, starting with section A2.
Let's read section A2, and I would ask the court to focus on that section because I agree it is very important to the lower court and the Navy's interpretation. And that section has, there's a paragraph in section A2 with four sentences in it. And the first sentence says, at the initial contract award, the government anticipates a staff of a certain specificity, and according to Your Honor's hypothetical, it would be lawyers with certificates of X, Y, and Z. They anticipate it. However, this is subject to change based upon the successful offeror's technical approach. And that's why I'm emphasizing who controls the technical approach. And then the third sentence says, the staff of 20 professionals is base minimum level of service, period. So
what about section H8, where any time there's a vacancy within the team of 20, they are required to replace someone among that 20 with a qualified replacement. That sounds like there's a lot in this contract that's saying you have to have 20 people.
Those are the only two places, Your Honor. And of those two, so H8 and A2 are the only two places in this contract.
Isn't that enough?
But okay, it's not enough because the result of that interpretation is to take away the technical approach from the contractor. First and foremost, and the most common sense answer to that is that's why that's not enough. It takes away the technical approach from the contractor, divorced from what the work actually is.
The technical approach being that the contractor gets to decide how talented the people need to be, or, you know.
No, what mix of people to have and what their experience should be. So I don't know if talent is the word, but the mix of the people and what their experience should be is critical. And the breadth of projects in Section C, I can't understate that enough. When we're talking about if it could be a dry dock or a house, or it could be a concrete runway, or it could be a number of other things that are called upon, and the contractor must deliver under Section C if those tasks are asked for. That's the technical approach. They have no choice or they will be in default. And so what the 20 is a baseline to estimate how much money they need to set aside for a firm fixed price contract where they take the risk that up to 20 people are going to have to be provided to meet any of the tasks in the breadth of Section C that could be required. And the government anticipates an A2. And in H8, the government states that there are 20. If you have 20 and there becomes a vacancy in the 20.
So you're reading it as up to 20? You're not reading it as a minimum of 20?
100%. Up to 20, yes. They anticipate a team of 20.
What is base minimum 20 professionals?
It ties to what the contractor must be prepared to cover with the firm fixed price, because they only get in section B1 in the CLIN, there's only $1 sign there. They get to put in one number to get paid, lump sum, firm fixed price.
That adds up to 20 professionals, right?
In this case, the government is communicating to the contractor in the context of procurement, yes, to put in a number that will cover 20 of these anticipated qualities. Okay.
What is your support for reading as up to 20 as opposed to reading the sentence on its face that Judge Chen just talked to you about?
Okay. Yeah. So that section it's simply from reading that section in the context of the three sentences. So the first sentence is anticipates this team. The second sentence is it changes based on technical approach of the contractor. The third sentence states the team is base minimum. Okay, so I read those together because they're 1, 2, 3. Anticipate, right? The contractor decides based on what the work actually is in section C. And then 3 is base minimum. And so I read that because in a lot of projects, the contractor has to have an idea of what the volume of work to
be. So to sum up, this paragraph in E2 is your support for up to 20. Is that correct?
I think that's, well, I read the whole contract in context. So part section C is important to that interpretation. Because
what is section C? I want you to be specific because you've pointed me to this paragraph, and now I think I've heard your argument.
It's very important. It's close, but it's not all of it. So I will say yes. Section C is the work statement. Is the performance work statement?
Can we look at the appendix page, and you can point out the exact language that you're relying on for your up to 20 argument you just made?
Yes, Your Honor. So. So at appendix 2966, through 2970 is the performance work statement. And on 2967, there's a list of services the contractor must perform but not limited to. Okay? And it lists out a host of services in 2.1 to 2.9, and they're not limited. And then on page 2967, the contractor supervises its own team to ensure compliance with this PWS. The contractor evaluates completed work in terms of compliance with policy and attainment of program objectives. So in this performance work statement, which the USC requires to specify what the work will be that is performed in a performance-based acquisition like this, and per FAR 37, that's where it needs to be. And what that says is they have an unlimited obligation to perform work that would be bounded by the value of the 20 people so that they can bid on 20 to create a price that they can meet the performance objectives.
Okay, Mr. Demme.
I'll reserve my time.
You have no time. You're well over your time, but we will give you a little bit of time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the government.
May it please the court. The trial court correctly concluded that the task order was a lawful contract that required ASG Solutions to submit the 20 resumes of senior technical experts within 5 days of contract award. And there was no violation of the personal services contract requirements in FAR 37.104D. And as a consequence of ASG's failure to comply with the requirements of the contract, the trial court correctly concluded that NAVFAC FCC was justified in terminating the contract for default because ASG did not comply with the contract requirements. To return to you completed your discussion with appellant's counsel. I think it would be helpful to talk about what the ASG submitted to the government in response to the solicitation, because it was required to submit a proposal, and the proposal was attachment 4, which became attachments 2 in the contract. Attachment 4 is found on page 2999, and it includes a list of 20 individuals identified as 4 architects, 4 mechanical engineers, 4 electrical engineers, 2 civil engineers, 2 structural engineers, fire protection engineer, cost protection engineer, and 2 supervisors. And these were the criteria that the government said it was interested in the successful offeror to provide as part of the team. These were not individual contracts or resumes, so to speak. This was a team effort, and they were looking for 20 individuals, and the 20 individuals the government proposed to be the four architects and the four mechanical engineers and so forth, as I just read. And the recommendations in part in the instructions to the offerors suggested that these individuals should be high professionals with a lot of experience and also with expert, you know, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees if possible, having certifications and licenses. Section MB3 in parens, small b in parens 2, 1 and double 1, those are on pages 3162. They talk about how the government is going to interpret and what it's looking for from the offerors. Section M does not end up being part of the contract, but it does request offerors to look at these various provisions as a method for keeping in mind as they were making a proposal. So not only were they looking for 20 individuals with professional experience, but also individuals that had licenses, master's degrees, and so forth.
What is the status of attachment 4, which became attachment 2?
Attachment 4 becomes attachment 2.
Right.
And that is...
Is that part of the contract? Which way
yes, it is.
In? And where do I look to determine that that is, in fact, part of, to be read as part of the contract?
Okay. In the contract itself, it's listed under Section J, List of Attachments, page 2992. And if you look down, it says a Section J, List of Attachments, and then it has Attachment 2, Attachment...
attachment 4, I see it.
Labor mix. And then under number 2 below, it has attachment plus 4 plus et cetera. That's an Excel spreadsheet.
And it's undisputed that Section J is, in fact, part of the contract. And
yes, it is.
And the incorporated portions of J are part of the contract.
Yes, they are, Your Honor. Yes, they are. The language in Section M is not part of the contract. It's actually not part of the physical contract.
Right.
But it says at the bottom of that page in Section M, as an instruction, as a recommendation to offerors, that it will become part, that the attachment 4 will become part of the contract.
What are the best, just looking at the contract itself, what are the best sections to support your argument? Without looking at extrinsic evidence, I just want to look at the contract itself. What would you point me to as the best sections?
Okay, the sections that I've been, that we've been referring to in our briefs are those sections. Section A, where it says the staff of 20 professionals is the base minimum level of service.
And what do you think it meant when it said it's anticipated we'll need 20?
Well, it says anticipates in that second paragraph on page 2959, section A2, but when it anticipates, the government wasn't requiring the offeror, the successful offeror, to have four architects, four mechanical engineers, even though those are identified in paragraph 2. But if you refer to appendix 2999, which is the submission of the ASG, then you find that they do, in fact, comply with all of those requirements. They're four mechanical engineers, four electrical engineers, et cetera.
And you said the government wasn't requiring it.
It wasn't requiring it.
It wasn't requiring it.
It was not requiring it, but...
When you say it wasn't requiring it,
wasn't
what is
requiring,
the it? Because you saying you were requiring 20... technical
absolutely
experts.
Absolutely, 20 were required.
So when you're saying you're not
but
requiring
in
it.
In terms of the the array, the various types
of professionals.
The composition
of the 20.
In other words, professional mechanical engineers, 4. Professional electrical engineers, 4. In other words, they were looking for that framework, and they said they would rate it higher if it had that particular 4 mechanical engineers, 4 electrical engineers.
So that list was essentially aspirational.
It is aspirational at that point, but the submission itself by ASG, which is at 2999, was responsive to that and complied with the aspirations of the Navy. So in fact, when the two were together...
What's your response to opposing counsel's argument that up to 20 is fine?
No, they require 20. There's nothing in here that says anything less than 20 is also fine. In fact, the Navy didn't know what it was going to be getting. It's possible that none of the offerors came up with 20, but it said in its evaluation process in Section M of the contract that the ones providing 20 would be given a higher priority than, and in fact, there would be a deduction if there were fewer than 20 being offered. So the Navy not only required it in the contract, but it said in the messages to the offerors that if they had less than 20, they would be given a deduction. So that is in the language in Section MB3B2.
And then it shows up in the contract, I guess, in H8.
Yes, it does. Okay. And in H8, they say if you have fewer than 20, you are going to get a reduction in price if you don't replace your 20, one of your 20, one or more of your 20 within 5 days. But we continue, we want you to fill it up to 20. We want to fill it up to 20 in Schedule 8A.
To go back to Judge Cunningham's earlier question, she was asking you to run through the contract and tell us where each place in the contract where you think that Navy was insisting on having a minimum of 20. And you started with A2, and
yes.
That says anticipate.
Well,
can you give us the places where you would say, I can give you 5 places in the contract where it's absolutely clear that 20 was a minimum that was required, anything less than 20, unsatisfactory.
Okay. Going back to A2, second paragraph, it says, and this is the second to last sentence in the second paragraph of A2, the staff of 20 professionals is base minimum level of service. CH for additional information regarding optional increased level of service.
Right.
Now that allowed the Navy to request an additional set of a couple of engineers of various types on top of that. But H8 that we just discussed also says if at any time there is a vacancy within the contractor's team, in paren, all 20 positions are not filled, the government will be entitled to immediate replacement within 5 days of loss of personnel, or to a unit price decrease in payment in accordance with 52.246-4.
Doesn't that, at least arguably, give the contractor the right to accept lower remuneration for fewer people? It says either or.
It says until the qualified technical experts is in place. Sorry, I didn't finish that sentence. So they can keep it up to 5 days or they lose, but they are supposed to bring it up to 20 because that is the base requirement. And in fact, in this case, the contractor said he will have 20. ASG said that they will have 20. That's what they say in Attachment 2, which is part of the contract under Section J. So those are the 3 places.
Are there any others that we should look at?
I am not aware of any others.
Okay.
And those are the ones that we've been arguing for. Understandably, you know, it is a complex contract, difficult to follow, but these are part of the contract.
Normally, wouldn't the performance work schedule have something like a reference to the 20 people, which you would expect, since that seems to be the way we're looking at it now, at least the core requirement of the contract, and it's not there? Right? I didn't see the 20 anywhere in the PWS.
The appendix 2999 doesn't have individuals named, but they have the qualifications identified.
But it doesn't say you need to have 20, right? Does it?
There's a list of 20.
Yeah.
And that's what the contract says that Section J says that Appendix 2 is part of the contract. So while it doesn't spell it out specifically, it does. This attachment, number 2, is incorporated as part of the contract. Sorry. And it has 20 individuals identified with the type of expertise they have. DOD experience, bachelor's and master's degrees, and
just to clarify,
experience.
Counsel,
more than
you're talking
10.
About appendix page 2999 as being part of the contract, and it identifies the 20. I just want to make sure.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
I think you're talking right now about appendix page 2999 as being part of the contract, and that's
yes.
What identifies the 20 people?
Yes.
Okay. So this is further support for the 20.
Yes, it
being
is.
Being a minimum.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And it is part of the contract under Section J, attachment number 2.
And I guess it's your view is that what the government bought through this contract was 20 experts that fit this specific profile on JA2999?
Specific profile in the sense that if they
four
were
architects,
they
with,
were all yes,
with this level of experience, four mechanical engineers with this level of experience, and
right.
So on.
And 20 senior experts. I mean, they could have submitted some as journeymen and some as seniors, but they, if you look at on page 2999, they're all senior experts. They all have more than 12 years of experience. So that gives them the senior status that the Navy was looking for. When you look at the master's and bachelor's degrees, they all have bachelor's degrees at least, and many of them have master's degrees. It suggests that they had specific people identified because they not only identify their years of experience, but they also identify where they went to school, Texas A&M University. That sort of thing. So the Navy thought they were getting specific individuals. They just were not named. As it turned out, they did not submit resumes of any individuals that specifically met these requirements.
Is that why the resumes were being rejected? Because the resumes didn't fit within any of these 20 profiles listed on A2999?
It wasn't so much the school where they went, but it was the combination of not all of them were senior status, not all of them had DOD experience, and not all of them had certificates or licenses. So where they didn't meet all those requirements, they were rejected.
So. Okay.
If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor. We respectfully request that the court affirm the decision below.
Okay, very good. Let's give Mr. Demian 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. additional section to consider in this contract analysis, to Judge Cunningham's question about where do we look for the up to 20. Section B1 on 2961 of the appendix, which is what we get paid for doing our work. And I mentioned there's a firm fixed price. And in the first CLIN on that line item, it states that we will be paid for working per the PWS. per the PWS, which is the prior section I cited to, Section C. And that's why the contractor is driven by that performance work statement for what must I do, and that performance work statement has an unlimited ask. And we heard a lot about Attachment 2, but it does not. Attachment 2 is a hypothetical group of character traits submitted for evaluation purposes and to establish criteria to achieve based on the contractor's implementation of his technical approach to satisfy the PWS.
But you agree that Section J is part of the contract? Do you agree with that?
Section J and its attachments are part of the contract. Yes. Yes. What's missing is any reference to Section J and language mandating the contractor do exactly what's in that Section J. So, and so what we have at minimum...
I didn't understand that. You say Section J is part of the contract, but what's missing is anything that requires the contract to do what Section J requires?
Correct. It's just attached. So what does it mean? And I have a meaning for it, but it's different than the Navy's and the judge.
You say it's just attached. It's part of the contract. You just told me that, right?
Section correct, J correct. And I don't mean it's...
Wait. Let me get my question out. I just want to hear you say it. Section J and its attachments are part of the contract, correct?
Yes.
But you followed up by saying, but they're not required to comply with the requirements of Section J.
Yes, they do not have to at all times provide exactly what's on Section J. There's no mandate. What the contractor has to provide is to deliver the services that are required to be performed to meet the objectives stated in that performance work statement. That's what has to happen. While performing those services, then the expectation is they will provide the experience that Judge Bryson mentioned for the lawyers and do it in a certain way. But the ultimate goal is the delivery of the services. And really briefly, because I have 20 seconds, H8. As to H8, it can only be read in concert with 52.246-4, which is the clause in the FAR, the contract clause in this contract that talks about inspecting services to determine whether they are deficient. Deficient services is the focus of that clause, and I agree with Judge Bryson's observation that that clause, to the extent we at some time had 20 have a vacancy, there's equivalent of an liquidated damages clause in there that handles this situation. But thank you for your consideration. I appreciate all the time you put into this.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is submitted.